This is a CC Radio podcast.
Welcome back to the Countdown Movie and TV Reviews Podcast, a bonus episode, this one being about my favourite 100 films of all time, and because Wayne is a little bitch and doesn't want to have to do all the work attached to having to do 100 films, I'm instead sourcing this out to some great independent movie podcasters that you know and love, and today is no exception for 90 through 81. I'm welcoming back G-Banger, Gerald, from Two Peas on a Podcast. Gerald, welcome back to the show.
Paulie, what's up, man? Thanks for having me. How you doing, brother?
I'm doing well, and it's a pleasure to have you back, Jill. Thank you for being one of the volunteers to do a higher up the end of the list, so you had to order more films. But from what we were talking about off mic, you actually have a definitive 250 film list.
I do, man. I kind of volunteered for this when I heard your initial running of it that you did when you started at 100, because I was like, well, wait a second. I have this list of all-time movies that, frankly, nobody cares about. So I was like, maybe Paul will care. He's doing
he
this.
Does.
So, I have this 250 list that I kind of keep updated. It was whenever I got Letterboxd, so probably like a year ago I did it. And then I just kind of update it whenever I see a new movie that might work its way into my 250.
Exactly. Yep.
I know we're doing 90 to 81. There's a couple newer movies in there that you'll hear that did insert themselves in the last year or so. And then a couple classics too. But yeah, man, thanks for having me. This is an awesome thing you do. And I think you know, but on my Patreon, I've started doing it with songs.
Yes, G-Tunes.
The G-Tunes, yeah. So I'm counting down my top 100 songs, and I'm doing it 10 at a time. And I kind of took that idea from this. So thank you for that as well.
You're very welcome. And it's a good fun series. Your DJ skills coming to the fore as you sort of mix in your thoughts and musings about the films.
Right.
The songs along with the songs themselves. So... it's well worth well worth checking out Gerald's Patreon if you haven't already, because for that alone, let alone all the extra content and early content and the like that Gerald puts up. So, and just briefly, in case someone's coming and is new to this, as the So Wizard podcast, people like to say every episode is someone's first episode. How about you tell that person about your show, because everyone else knows.
Well, thanks, man. I mean, it's always funny when you and I get together because we do have very similar formats, right? So I do a countdown show as well. And, you know, mine's a top five show. So we do kind of a quick kind of in and out top five in any given genre or subject. But it's usually movies, TV, or music. Those are the three things that we stick to for the most part. You know, like yourself and a lot of folks, movies often dominate the conversation because there's just so much great stuff there to talk about. But, you know, we just kind of cover all those facets of pop culture. And I have a rotating guest host every week. So I'm there every week and I bring in, you know, someone like yourself, and your buddy Wayne was on a few weeks ago for Tom Cruise movies.
Yep. Blew my mind that Jerry Maguire was not his number one.
No, how crazy was that, man? I was really surprised by that too. I was waiting for it the whole show and I'm like, well, it's going to be his number one because he hasn't said it yet. And then it wasn't. So, and I don't even think he put it in his honorables now that I'm thinking about it. I think we talked about it, but I don't think he had it in his honorables.
We've broken Wayne finally after five and a bit years of podcasting. We've broken him. He's changed all his views on films, and here we go.
Oh, man. But yeah, we just do a fun, you know, top five countdown show, and I have a rotating guest host each week. It's, you know, either a patron of mine or a friend of mine or another podcaster like yourself and Wayne, and you just come in and... usually the guests will pick the topic and we just have fun and count down those movies or songs or whatever the case may be.
Yeah, and that's exactly what it sounds like. It's good fun. And obviously I enjoy it because I'm a list person. And so do check out Two Peas on a Pod when you get a chance. Now, you mentioned that you sort of added to your list. You got a couple of new ones in your 90 through 81. Well, for those who listened to the first episode of this with Julio from The Contrarians, we did 100 to 91. I finished out my 91 with Inglourious Basterds. And since then, I've added a film to my list. So everything slid down one for me. So I have to give a quick shout out to my new 91, if you were like it was my 90. Now, Judgment Night has slipped off my top 100. It's gone. It's now in the 101, the coveted 101 spot. and instead, at number 91 now, having shuffled down, is from, very quickly, the horror comedy classic, The Return of the Living Dead from 1985, written and directed by Dan O'Bannon. I know you've seen that one, Gerald. I know it's a bit of I think it's a favorite of yours from memory on your show.
Yeah, it was my number one zombie movie.
There we go.
We did that this past October, and it's definitely in my top 250. It's not going to come up tonight on the 10 that we're talking about, but it's I mean, like I said, it's my favorite zombie movie of all time, yep. And it has 1980s, you know, written all over it, which I love also.
Yeah, and for me, it has a special place in my heart because I saw it too young, probably as a 12-year-old, give or take, and it did actually scare me. And the way it ended on such a nihilistic note is something that's always stuck with me, mm-hmm. to say nothing about, you know, zombies that can talk and actually tell you why they're doing what they're doing, which is a creepy kind of concept to me. And then, of course, some of the great zombie designs, including Tarman, the greatest zombie ever made, as far as I'm concerned. Walking Dead be damned.
Right. And I'm sure Trash Dancing in the Cemetery had a little something to do.
may have done at that particular age.
Yeah, of course.
All right, so that's just a quick little shout out to my new number 91. Let's get into it then, Gerald, today. 90 through 81, of course, the holy grail being, will we have one film that crosses over in this tent? It hasn't happened with Julio. Man. Let's see if it will happen today. Take us away, your number 90.
All right, man. Well, my number 90, we were just talking about horror. This film could fall in the horror realm, but it's really weird because it's like a horror high school kind of teen comedy. It's a dark comedy, but it was written by Diablo Cody, and it's a movie I love starring Megan Fox. Ooh. Jennifer's Body,
okay,
from 2009 would be my number 90 film of all time.
Weirdly topical as well, because she's just come back up in the media all about
her heinous treatment from
Michael Bay and how sexualized she was as an underage actor, and that's just awful. So, yeah, okay, please continue.
Yeah, I did see that too today, which is kind of ironic on me, but this movie was already on my list.
Sure.
But Amanda Seyfried I also love, who plays Needy in the film. And it's a very sexy movie, and it's, like I said, it's a dark comedy, and it's got horror elements built into it too. But Megan Fox, this is where she shines. I mean, and I'm talking about in her career, in my opinion, because her delivery in this movie and how she, you know, portrays Jennifer, she's so witty, and just her delivery is on point, man. Like, she is just an A1 bitch in this movie, and I love her, and I don't feel like she's ever done better than this in her career from an acting standpoint. This is her most memorable role, in my opinion. And I love Diablo Cody's style of writing, too, and how she writes women. And I just think it's a very beautiful, sexy kind of story of friendship and kind of overcoming kind of the masculinity that is perpetrated by the folks that end up turning Jennifer in the beginning of the film, and their kind of like cult van or whatever. I'm sure you'll recall that. But yeah, I just love this movie, man. I think it's got a little bit of everything, and it's just a fun watch for me.
It's one I've only watched once, and I wasn't that blown away by at the time, but I keep hearing people like you talking about it in such glowing, warm terms. I think I probably need to revisit it and see what I missed.
I would say so, man. I mean, you got Amanda Seyfried and Megan Fox kind of making out, so I don't know what to tell you, Paul. I mean, if that's not doing it for you, I don't know. Yeah, it's a great film, man. Especially you being a horror guy, I feel like you could get into this, and if you look at it with fresh eyes, maybe you'll enjoy it.
Yeah, maybe I didn't give it enough of a chance at the time. I don't remember what was sort of going on. How many years ago was that?
Let's see. That came out in 2009.
Okay, so over 10 years ago. Damn, getting old, Gerald. Yeah, getting old.
Yeah. Right, tell me about it, man.
All right, well, speaking of getting old, my number 90 is even older. It's from 1988. It's one of my most beloved classic in, you know, quotation marks, horror films. It's The Blob, the remake of The Blob, directed by Chuck Russell from 1988.
Yeah, man. Scary shit. Memorable.
I think this film is just a little sleeper gem. It's so cool as a horror film. Like, it takes that really cheesy 50s horror with Steve McQueen and updates it to this, at the time, pretty visceral, gory, unapologetic horror film, which offs people left and right out of nowhere. Like, this film is one of those, you can kind of, by 40 minutes in, kind of see who the hero and heroine are, but up until that point, it's kind of up for grabs, and it could be anyone, and then they start getting picked off in ways that you don't expect, and some really memorable sort of gory kills, right from the guy that's making out with his girlfriend in the car, and then the blob gets into her and basically eats her from the inside out, and then sucks his hand in as he's filling up her breast. Sounds better than it is. To another character who's a main character who sort of disappears off screen, and then you see him sort of float past in the middle of the blob, his skeleton and skull and the like, and before it presses in on a phone box and destroys the person inside there. There's just some really iconic, to my mind, imagery in here, and it has that sort of, you know, we are our own worst enemy kind of vibe as well, because, of course, the blob turns out to be man-made and the scientists are trying to stop it and all the rest of that. So, yeah, I dig the shit out of this. Kevin Dillon, you know, Johnny Drama from Entourage, and Shawnee Smith, and I used to have a bit of a crush on Shawnee Smith around this sort of age when I was 13 or 14. She's quite lovely. So, between all those things, big ticks for me, and it's one of my favorite horror films ever, hence my number 90.
That's a good one, man. And I don't know if you recall, we talked about this when we did our 80s horror together, yeah, you and I.
That's right.
And I believe you had it on your list for that, too. And
absolutely.
This is a good one, man. You know, the thing that jumps out to me with The Blob, and I need to rewatch this, because I think I told you when we did that episode as well, I just haven't seen this in probably 10, 15 years.
Sure.
But even still, just very memorable, man. I mean, some of the scenes in that movie, you'll just never forget after you see them. So that's great movie making, in my opinion. So great pick, man.
Thank you, sir. Over to you.
All right, so my number 89, I was telling you there's a couple in this 10 that are newer films, and this is a film that came out last year, and it was directed by one of my favorite filmmakers. Or I'm sorry, it actually came out in 2018. Directed by one of my favorite filmmakers, Yorgos Lanthimos, but it's a film called The Favorite.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yep.
Yeah, absolutely.
Good film.
You saw this. Okay.
Yeah, good film.
Absolutely fell in love with this film. You know, Lanthimos uses a lot of like natural light in this film, all natural light in this film, actually, in The Favorite, which I didn't know when I saw it. And then it made so much sense when I heard that. But, you know, it harkens back to Kubrick's Barry Lyndon and those kind of movies that, you know, use natural light like that. It's just such a beautiful way to showcase the landscapes involved, but also just the actors' portrayals and not taking anything away from what they're doing. Rachel Weisz, Emma Stone, and Olivia Colman give the best performances of their respective careers in one film. So think about that. Ooh, if you have three actors, cool. This is my opinion, of course, but if you have three actors or actresses and they're each giving the performance of their life in the same movie, then that is a powerhouse acting clinic that you're watching as an audience member or somebody on the set that's, you know, that's seeing this firsthand. Olivia Colman won the Academy Award for this. And I think she should have. She absolutely endeared herself to the world, myself included. I literally fell in love with her when I saw this movie, but more so like her awards kind of tour that she went on with the talk shows, and her acceptance speeches were so cute and endearing. And she's just such a charmer, man. And she did so good in this movie because, you know, Queen Anne is such a tragic figure. And this is another dark comedy, much like my Jennifer's Body pick. So it's kind of told from like, yeah, it's dark material, but it's also kind of silly at the same time. And she just really sells that well, where she walks that fine line, because Queen Anne is a very tragic figure. But they kind of tell it from the lighter side. And I mean, his filmmaking is really unique, right? Because there's that one scene where it's like people are almost like breakdancing, like it was the 1980s.
That's,
you know,
right.
That one, yes, scene. So he has a really unique style of filmmaking. It was almost like a music video at certain points. And despite the time period that it was taking place. So this is one of my favorites, no pun intended. And spoiler alert, I'm going to be discussing our top five period piece films, and I wonder if I'll mention this.
I reckon yes.
Yeah, I love this movie, man. What did you think of it? Yeah. I haven't heard you talk about this one, I don't think.
Very, very good. I enjoyed it a lot. I think I gave it sort of 4 stars. So, you know, it's not a mile off this list. It doesn't make my top 100, but I dug it for all the reasons that you did. I probably particularly enjoyed the technical aspects of the film, as you say, the natural lighting. But for me, this sort of fisheye lens that he has and the way it sort of rotates the camera around quite a bit rather than sort of moving in a traditional way or cutting between static shots and the occasional very slow push in or pull out. So those parts I really enjoyed. But yes, the story itself, very engaging, a lot of fun, very tongue-in-cheek, but as you say, tackling some pretty serious issues, at least in terms of this tragic historical figure. So, and to say nothing of the performances, which are all very good. And yeah, obviously Olivia Colman for sure, her best.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I might think about Emma Stone and Rachel Weisz before I made that call. But yeah, good film and a worthy choice.
Yeah, Emma Stone, I mean, you know, I've never been like a giant fan of Emma Stone's. Like, she's one of those actors that I'm like, you know, I like her. Like, I don't dislike her, but I never go, holy shit, she's amazing. But in this movie, that's what I said, because I felt like she was the most layered character in this movie, where she started out as the underdog, kind of like being bullied character. And by the end of the movie, you know, not to give away any plot spoilers, but I mean, she takes a hierarchy where she's like the antagonist, like enemy at the end of the film, you know, and she went through the span of that in 90 minutes. So I thought she sold it really well. And I had never seen her really
range it that way,
have a character of that depth in her career. Yeah.
Fair enough. All right. I think maybe there's only one on these 10 that might be more critically loved than that film, but that was a big winner in that regard. My 89 is a bit different.
All right, fair enough.
It's from 1997. It's from Hong Kong action maestro John Woo. It's Face Off.
Oh, yeah. Okay, good. I'm surprised it's this low for you. I know
I know this is going to upset a lot of people, I think, having this particular action film so low on the list. But for me, as much as I love Face Off and have a great time with it, it is extraordinarily long at 140 minutes. And it really does sort of extend things a little bit too far in some scenes. And the John Woo-ness gets a little bit to me a little bit much on rewatch. But it's a great time. It's hilariously fun. It's the most ridiculous premise ever that Nicolas Cage and John Travolta could change faces and no one would notice. Because they haven't changed anything else other than I think they did talk about sort of slimming them up or sucking body fat out a little bit. But otherwise, I don't want to be too graphic here, but Wayne and I have talked about this on our show. Their genitalia would not be the same. Right. And yet, Nicolas Cage sleeps with John Travolta's wife and she doth not notice anything. Let's just put it that way.
Right. I think I heard you guys mention that when it came up on another show of yours. But, I mean, this is a great one, man. I mean, this is one where you have two actors in Cage and Travolta that are traditionally known, especially Cage, but they're just traditionally known for just hamming it up. You know what I mean?
Chewing the scenery.
Just chewing it. And you have both of them just doing that, man, for 2 hours. And that's why this is such a fun watch. You know, I recently did our top five Nick Cage movies, and I didn't put this one on there.
More controversial.
I do love it. Yeah, I know, but I do love it. I just, I don't feel like I love it as much as like the consensus, but I do enjoy this one.
Yeah, I think a lot of your mileage will go with how much you love action cinema and particularly John Woo's style of action cinema, which I happen to be a huge fan of. There's at least one other John Woo film on my list, which is coming up much later that I revere. So yeah, Face Off is my 89.
Good pick, man. I love that movie. It's a lot of fun. All right, so 88 for me, right? So my number 88 is a biopic, and it's another one of my favorite filmmakers of all time. And it came out the year I graduated high school and really was a history lesson for me, introducing me to someone that I had never heard of prior to seeing this movie in 94. And since seeing it, I've studied this guy. I'm a big fan of, you know, a lot of other characters in this movie as well because they're based on real people. But it's a movie by Tim Burton called Ed Wood.
Oh, wow.
My number 88. So, you've seen this?
I have, but a long time ago. So, I couldn't speak to it any other than I remember it was black and white and Johnny Depp having a lot of fun. Yeah. So, otherwise, it's sort of lost in the mists of my mind.
Well, that's true. I mean, it's based on Ed Wood as a real dude. And, you know, he's often referred to as the worst filmmaker of all time. That's his kind of staple. And what's interesting and what I love about, you know, him and just his story is that he had nothing. You know, he had nothing. He had no money. He had no connections in Hollywood. He just wanted to make movies, regardless of what was accessible to him or what was available to him. And, of course, this was obviously well before the digital age, too. So, you know, it was a situation, I'm sure you've heard of Plan 9 from Outer Space, which a lot of people say is the worst movie ever made. And he made that with some friends of his. And he, you know, would use like styrofoam balls as Saturn. You know, that's what the movie is. It's like a bunch of props that he like found laying around at his house or in a junkyard. But the movie really, you know, is about that and his legacy. But it's really about the friendship that he forges with Bela Lugosi. Bela Lugosi famously played the first cinematic Dracula. Well, maybe not the first one, but the most traditionally popular one. And is portrayed by Martin Landau, who won the Academy Award for his portrayal of Bela Lugosi. And Lugosi is a very tragic figure, and that's kind of the drama of the film. And then the comedy comes into play with Johnny Depp's character and portrayal of Ed Wood, because it's almost like a caricature, where he's almost impersonating kind of a cartoonish version of Ed Wood. And Tim Burton, I love too. I mean, I think you know this about me, but I'm a big fan of his, and I like his kind of dark sensibility. So this is one of my favorite biopics ever as well, and it's on my list at 88.
Right. Well, a little surprising to me, but I'm glad that it had such an impact. And again, you being maybe more of a, I don't know, traditional cinephile with your list than my very genre-heavy one is. So it's good to get a balance.
I'm not trying to be a movie bro, but I mean, I don't know. It was so endearing to me that this guy, you know, somebody that so has the label. Yeah, somebody that has the label as the worst filmmaker of all time, but yet their impact is so huge. Do you know what I mean? That's just so fascinating to me.
Yep.
So I think that's why I fell in love with it.
Very nice. Okay. My number 88 is another genre outing, shock horror, and indeed it is a horror. It's from Scott Derrickson, the guy who went on to direct Doctor Strange and recently relinquished the reins of the sequel due to creative differences, which is a bit of a shame because I think he's actually got a great eye for these kinds of things. It's Scott Derrickson and his 2012 film Sinister.
Oh, okay. I like this one a lot.
Sinister, I think, is a wildly underrated Blumhouse horror film.
I agree.
Just kind of overlook because it's, you know, Blumhouse and Scott Derrickson, and it's just got Ethan Hawke in it. But I think it's really effective. It's one of the creepiest films I've seen in the last decade, easily. And I remember, I will never forget the night I watched it, sitting not long after my daughter was born, up in by myself, all the lights were off in the house, and probably already tired and on edge because we weren't getting much sleep at that point in our lives. And then I watched this movie, and I got back into bed and woke my partner up, and she said, you know, what did you watch? And I had to tell her the whole film because it was so vivid in my mind, and she's just like, yeah, whatever, go to sleep. But for me, it really creeped me out. And the idea of there's this ghoul or this demon that's hidden in these Super 8 footage of families being murdered is really sinister. It's really creepy. And then the way that mystery unfolds, I think, works really well. There's some nice little touches in there, including James Ranson's deputy so-and-so. He never gets a name, which I didn't realize till the end credits because he's such a character in the film, which is kind of cool. And the end, I think, is really clever. So big ticks for me on every level. Like, Sinister is my 88.
Yeah, Sinister is a great film. I know you're a horror buff, much like myself, and I'm surprised to find this one getting thrown out with all the horror that exists out there. But with that being said, I don't get scared a ton when I watch horror movies.
Likewise.
And I remember Sinister really scared me. There were a lot of scenes, and it could have been a product of, you know, I was watching it in the dark by myself at home.
Yep, so that'll help.
That may not have been wise, but yeah, that could have something to do with it. But I mean, yeah, I do remember it was very scary, and there was a lot of great horror imagery that, you know, is meant to scare you. And I don't mean the cheap jump scares, which those can be fun. This was more of a, you know, just kind of like ominous vibe.
Dread that
existed. Yeah, yeah. But I do like this movie. I'm just surprised to hear it be on your list.
Yeah, I think a lot of people would be surprised. But again, when it comes to favorite films rather than best films, you kind of go with the ones that have that gut punch impact on you at whatever level. And for this one, as you say, for a horror film to scare me, it's very, very rare. So that's why it gets in here.
Well, good pick, man. I would love to revisit it. You know, I didn't see that when I came out. I just saw that maybe like a year and a half, 2 years ago. So I just saw that recently, and I really dug it. So good pick. My number 87 is also horror, and it's a movie that I want to say you and I have talked about before. I can't remember if it was on the P's or if it was on the countdown, but it is Ari Aster's Hereditary from 2018.
You're right. Yes, also on my list. So low.
Wow, nice. Well, I'm glad to hear that, actually. I think when you came on and we did movies of the decade, I feel like I had it on my top five of the decade, and that was when we discussed it.
Yeah, but geez, your memory's good. Well done to you.
Yeah, I just love it, man. I mean, you know why, but I mean, Ari Aster's style of filmmaking and this kind of gloom and doom filmmaking that he does that's very in your face and just hard to... It's like, you know, when you see a car wreck or a train wreck and you can't look away, that's kind of how his films are, especially when he's dealing with tragedy and grief, and he's done that in both of his features, with Midsommar as well. And I love both of them pretty much equally, but I think I give the nod to Hereditary
because
of the boost of this man's career. I mean, along with Jordan Peele, I would say Ari Aster is probably my favorite current filmmaker, like actively making movies right now. Just his eye for it and how dark it is just speaks to me. And it's, you know, he deals with these issues of like loss and grief and things that don't traditionally find themselves in the middle of a horror movie. Do you know what I mean? And then he does give you that imagery we were just talking about with Sinister too. You have that imagery. There's a lot of scenes in Hereditary and in Midsommar that you will never forget when you see them because of how they're shot and the stylized way that he gives you these kind of horrific things that you have to ingest as a viewer.
Yep.
I mean, you can't escape it, especially if you're in the theater or whatever. So I love Ari Aster. I love Hereditary. I mean, you've heard me talk about this probably too much, to be honest, but one of my favorite movies of the last few years, so it fell at my number 87.
Great choice. 100% obviously behind you. I'll just add one other thing because I'll save up when I do talk about it myself, but Toni Collette is incredible in this movie. And I also think Alex Wolff as her son is very, very good in a role that probably got lost underneath the gloss of Toni Collette's performance, but I think he sells some of his scenes, which requires some pretty heavy lifting in an exceptional way too. And otherwise, I agree everything you said.
Yeah, just such a quiet, subdued performance by him. You know, and that's what he's meant to be. He's meant to kind of be in shock and awe the whole time.
Exactly.
And he sells it so well. And I've heard critics, which kind of bum me out, say, like, you know, he wasn't doing anything or he didn't. And I'm like, you're not getting it. Like, that, correct. You know, that is the character. Do you know what I mean? But yeah, Toni Collette is, I mean, I didn't mention that on this particular dialogue, but you've heard me.
I have, yep.
I mean, I almost drove to Hollywood when the Academy didn't nominate her a couple years ago, and like, what the hell is wrong with you guys? And then same thing with Lupita last year for Us. I mean, just, it's horror. Yeah, I get it. But I mean, the performance is just so entrancing, you know, yep. It's just so multi-layered and multidimensional, and she's a great actress. So I agree with you 100%.
And the simple reason she didn't get nominated is because whoever released Hereditary wouldn't have had the money to campaign for the Oscars to get her in. So
yeah, you're right. Yeah. It's political. You're right.
Yeah, unfortunately. Yep. Though that said, you know, not to speak out of turn here and tell tales. Yes, I am going to tell tales. I've heard whispers from multiple fronts that Toni Collette is not a very nice person. So.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, which is a bit of a shame. But I won't go into that. That's, again, emphasizing hearsay. That's all.
I am your mother. What do you mean? I'm just kidding. Go ahead.
All right. My number 87 is a Danny Boyle film, which, again, flies under the radar. No pun intended when you hear the film. It's from 2007. It's one of the most beautiful films I've ever seen. It's Sunshine.
Sunshine? Just the name Sunshine?
Yep.
I don't know that I know this.
Oh, well,
I don't know that. I don't,
add it to your list, sir, because I think you are, your sensibilities will be one of the people that really digs this film. It is basically a film set 50 years into the future where Cillian Murphy, Rose Byrne, Chris Evans, Michelle Yeoh, among others, are sent on this desperate attempt to reignite the sun with their payload of whatever it is, nuclear weapons or whatever kind of weapons.
What?
Yeah.
How did I miss this?
And so the Earth is descending to these Arctic temperatures. We only get a very occasional, very little glimpse of Earth, I think, at the start and at the end of the film. That's it. Whereas the entire film is taking place on this ship. And they're the second attempt to do this. The first ship disappeared. And they are following sort of along the similar course and hoping to avoid the same fate of that ship. And all I'll say then, because you haven't seen it, and again, it flies under the radar, so I think there's a lot of listeners who would fall into that camp. It shifts in the last act. I love the shift. But I understand people who don't dig it, who think it really cheapens the what came before the rest of the film. So but watch this film. It's so beautifully shot. It's also written by Alex Garland, if that helps you at all.
Oh, wow. That helps big time. I can't believe I fucking missed this, though. This sounds like right up my alley.
Yeah, it's really cool. Sci-fi, I wouldn't call it action. Sci-fi thriller is probably the best description of this particular film. So check it out. Sunshine is fantastic. That's my 87.
Will do, man. It's on the list, brother. All right, so my number 86 is a rare gem. I think, you know, we've been mentioning terms like under the radar and underseen. I feel like that is the case with this movie because there's a lot of prominent people in it, but it gets forgotten about in a lot of their kind of like catalogs of work.
Okay.
So it was directed by Clint Eastwood. So Clint Eastwood directed film, and it stars Kevin Costner. It came out in 1993, but it's a movie called A Perfect World.
Oh, Wayne loves this one. So he'll be cheering you on here.
I do too, man. Have you seen it, Paul?
Yes, I have, but I can't. I mean, I watched it at the time, but I don't have really fond or strong memories of it. It was a film I watched. So, again, one that clearly, if you're endorsing it so highly, I need to revisit.
Yeah, this one, you know, I was still in high school. I was like a junior or senior in high school, and my mom took me to see it because she was a big Eastwood and Costner fan. And, of course, they're working together here because Eastwood is also in the movie. He has a supporting role in the movie. Laura Dern is in this, kind of young in her career. It tells, I mean, it's a pretty basic story. It takes place in the early 1960s. I want to say it's like 62 or 63. And Costner is a convict, and he escapes from jail. And in order to stay on the run, he kidnaps a little 8-year-old boy named Philip from this like neighborhood that he's strolling through. And the story is like him and this boy are on the run from the feds and from this U.S. Marshal portrayed by Eastwood. And Eastwood's the one kind of hunting them down. And, of course, this is in the 60s, so the technology's, you know, not where it is now and so on. So it's literally just a cat and mouse kind of game. But the movie has so much heart, bro, because as you're watching the movie, the little boy's story starts to unfold. And you learn that, you know, there's no father figure. His dad left when he was very young. He's a Jehovah's Witness, so his family doesn't celebrate birthdays or Halloween or anything like that. So Costner, as this good old American boy growing up with all those things, starts to kind of show this boy all these things that he's been missing his childhood. And they become very close. It's kind of like a Florence Nightingale type thing where they endear themselves to each other. And at the end of the day, it's a very tragic ending because this is a convict on the run. Do you know what I mean? So it's not going to end well for him. But it's very emotional. And, you know, I cry at the end of this movie, and I've seen it probably 10 times. And every time I see it, I get a little teary-eyed because of the relationship that they, the bond that they form that we witness and how it kind of ends. But, it, you know, I love movies that kind of take place in that time period, too, like that JFK era of the early 1960s. I really like, too. But, yeah, this is some of Eastwood's best work behind the camera. And I know Kevin Costner is kind of like a love him or hate him type of actor, but I like him a lot. And I've seen very few projects of his that I haven't enjoyed. So I think it's underseen. If anybody's into it, check it out. It's called A Perfect World from 1993.
Yep. Okay. I might give that one another shot, given if you're saying that by the end it's causing a few tears to come out, even after multiple viewings, you know, that's one that's that's hit you deep. So,
yeah, man.
Nice. All right, my 86 is a classic, and it's one which we've spoken about ad nauseum on the show. Everyone knows it if you're of our vintage, but if you're younger, it may have passed you by. And if you watched it now, you will not get the same appreciation out of it. It's at that era of film. It's from 1986. It's from John Carpenter, and it stars Kurt Russell in Big Trouble in Little China.
Nice. Gotta love it, man.
Yeah, it's such a great, fun, ridiculous film. I did this huge deep dive about a year ago on this film on the Binge Movies podcast with Jason from that show. A lot of fun to talk about in such detail and depth. So seek that one out if you really want to hear my full thoughts about it and score and all the rest of it. But basically, it's Kurt Russell playing this blowhard, very funny dude who thinks he's the hero in his own story, but by the end of the film, it actually ends up being the bumbling sidekick, which is just super cool and in a sort of subversive way beyond the fact that it is funny. It is very inventive. It becomes this over-the-top fantasy film and kung fu film, really, first and foremost, set in a largely Western setting, although in Chinatown in San Fran, I think. I can't remember off the top of my head. And it just goes places you will not be expecting and has some great, great lines, including, "It's all in the reflexes, Wang. It's all in the reflexes."
Right.
That's why. And also, Kurt Russell, at this point in his career, was just so charismatic, so personable, and it shines through in this role.
Yeah, I agree, man. I'm a big Carpenter fan, as I think you know that as well. And this is a great movie, man. Great pick. It's just nostalgic, and John Carpenter and Kurt Russell, it's amazing, man. It's a good pick for sure.
On your 250, Gerald, or no?
This one is not. I do have a couple Carpenter films. I have a couple Carpenter films in my 250.
You're killing me, Smalls.
But I do love it. It's so hard, man. I don't know about you, but when you were doing the 100, you were probably like, wow, that's it? 100? Like, I feel like there's so many more that deserve love. You know, it's just tough, man.
But, and every so often, someone's going to bring one up. I'm going to go, oh, probably should have been on my list. And then I'll have to play it with a straight face. So let's see if your 85 is, your 85 is one of those.
I know it's not, Paul. I was about to say, this one is definitely not on your list because it's a goddamn musical, buddy.
Oh,
so, ba-pow. I have very few musicals in my 250.
Thank God.
In fact, I might have to go back and look. I don't, unless you count The Wizard of Oz, which I guess people would count that as a musical. But otherwise, this might be the only other musical, and it's pretty recent. La La Land, man. It's my number 85.
Yeah, okay. I know how much you love this movie.
You do. I just rewatched this the other day because I introduced it to my son. He's almost 7 years old. And he loves Hamilton right now. And they're releasing that on Disney Plus, and he's really excited about that. And I was like, I got a musical that I love because I don't really like a ton of musicals. I was like, let me show you this one, you know. So he was kind of in and out of it. You know, like he would lose interest when they weren't doing song and dance numbers. Yeah. So he didn't watch like from beginning to end, but he saw a lot of the dance numbers and he enjoyed it. But I mean, you know, we were talking about Emma Stone earlier, so I didn't expect to have two Emma Stone movies on my list here.
In this
set of 10. But I mean, the vibrant colors, the direction of Damien Chazelle, you know, he's a filmmaker that I love anyway. And I love how he incorporates music and then in his movies. And then in this case, you just have a full-blown musical. And it's just so colorful, man. It reminds me of movies like, you know, An American in Paris and some of the old school film Singing in the Rain that were so colorful and fun. And, you know, they might end on a bit of a down note, but the movie as a whole makes you feel good. It's a feel good movie, which I guess is the point of musicals for the most part anyway. But yeah, I'm kind of like you where I'm not like
a
huge musicals guy, but I don't know why La La Land just, I just dug it, man. I don't know why. I can really, I'm being honest with you as I'm sitting here right now, Paul. I really can't explain why I like this one so much more than other musicals.
Look, I'll concede this to you, Gerald. If I had to pick a musical, and one day I suspect we'll have to do that top 10, this would be very high. Like, of musicals, this is a good one for me. Maybe because it does a lot of, I don't know, it does a lot of things that I really appreciate in a technical aspect. I particularly like the camera movements that Damien Chazelle employs, that those techniques. One or two of the songs aren't terrible, particularly the first one. In our house, that's called the foot tap song because my daughter, what was it, 2 years ago, 3 years ago? She heard that song and really liked it because, and it made her tap her foot, so it became known as the foot tap song.
Oh, nice, nice.
And it's still referred to that way whenever it sort of comes up on whatever playlist my fiance has for her on her phone. So, yeah, it has a little place in our heart, in this house, but it's still a musical. It's still stupid the way everybody can just burst into song and move in sync. But otherwise, yeah, I get it.
Yeah, that part kind of, you got to get used to that. You know, I like Chazelle's set designs too, and the production design and just the way it looks, too. I just feel like it's a really beautiful, beautifully shot movie, too, which helps my level of enjoyment of it. But, you know, I know the Oscars have this rap, and it's true, but I'm in the camp, too, where I often, like, I love movies about movies, you know, which I know the Oscars get that rap, but
they do.
That's kind of how I feel, too. I like the kind of old school Hollywood vibe in La La Land. So,
and she won the Academy Award for this, if I remember correctly, Emma Stone. So there you go.
She did.
All right. My 85 is a different kind of film again, as is often the case when we do this, you know, comparison of 100 favorite films. It's from 1995. It is a claustrophobic submarine thriller. It's Crimson Tide.
Oh, nice. Wow. I hadn't seen this in forever.
Yeah.
Okay.
Young Denzel, relatively young Denzel, a relatively old Gene Hackman, and it basically follows a submarine which gets sort of cut off through various measures, and like their last communication from their command center is basically suggesting that you should fire your nuclear weapons at Russia, I think it was. And Gene Hackman is all for following through on that, but Denzel Washington, as his XO, is like, well, hang on. We haven't got all the authentication. We haven't got all the corroboration we need. We need to hold off. And it becomes this battle of wills with the crew taking sides between these two senior officers on the boat. It's got a bunch of people in sort of minor roles, including George Zunza from Basic Instinct, Viggo Mortensen, and James Gandolfini, obviously two bigger names there. Steve Zahn as well in a little role. So it's got all these little bits and pieces. It's a very testosterone sort of driven film, but it's really tense. And it's that Tony Scott directed this film, rest in peace.
Right. I was going to mention that. Yeah, I love Tony Scott movies.
And he's got this particular style where he's really close in on actors' faces and lets their acting do all the work, if you will. And it works in a submarine film exceptionally well. And it's got this awesome score by Hans Zimmer to go with it too. So that's why I love this movie so much.
Cool, man. Good pick. It's one that I haven't seen in forever. I mean, I've seen it and I know that I love it. And I love Tony Scott films, generally speaking. So I need to revisit that one. I haven't seen it in a long time.
Give it a shot, I reckon. I think you'll dig it.
Absolutely, man. All right, so my 84 is a film that has a bit of a blemish on it as of late, but it hasn't really fallen in terms of my love for it, and it's American Beauty from 1999.
Oh, okay. Yep.
Won the Academy Award that year for Best Picture.
Very good film.
You've got Sam Mendes in the director's chair here, of course, famous right now for 1917, which was also an amazing film. Skyfall, Road to Perdition, some other stuff that he's done I really like as well. So generally speaking, I like his style of filmmaking, but American Beauty is cool because the spacey factor aside, I mean, this is a story of a middle-aged man in the suburbs who is grown weary of his situation. He's weary of his job. He's weary of his marriage. His kids don't particularly like him. You know, he's just kind of hit a dead end in a midlife crisis. I mean, is what this movie really is about, at least following Lester's story. And I like some of the subplots in the movie, too. I mean, Chris Cooper is absolutely fucking on another level in this movie as the kind of homophobic next-door neighbor. Just an amazing ex-military role that he takes on in this film. But yeah, I love American Beauty, man. I mean, the imagery, Sam Mendes' style of filmmaking, some of the best performances of these actors' careers. You know, I know Spacey is a creep, for lack of a better way to put it.
Unfortunately.
Yeah, but I mean, from an acting perspective, there's some movies that he did, particularly in the 90s. American Beauty is one of them that, you know, his performance was on another level. So from an acting, you know, only from an acting standpoint.
I think we make the point on our show quite a bit that we try to separate the person from the craft. So
sure.
We all think he's a complete piece of shit and he's done in Hollywood. We'll never have to deal with him again. But at the same time, what a loss, because his craft is, generally speaking, was, particularly around this period, as you're saying, excellent. So
right. Yeah, I don't know, man. I mean, I don't know about you, but he was one of those people, when I heard that last year, I think it's been about a year now that all that came out, that it was like genuinely a bummer. Like, I was really kind of like sad, because I was like, well, I really like this guy as an actor. Do you know what I mean? So yep. it was different than hearing like just a random name that, you know, if it wasn't somebody you were a fan of, do you know
That's
what
right.
I mean? I feel like I, you know, a year ago or 2 years ago, I would have called myself a fan of Kevin Spacey, you know.
Likewise.
As an actor. And that was just a bummer when that happened and when that came out. And then not only that, the way he reacted to it.
Oh, God.
Being dismissive about it and those creepy videos he's been putting out on YouTube and all that. I don't know if you saw those.
No, I haven't seen those. I've just steered
right. Oh, please don't watch those, bro. I mean, I know you're a horror fan, but don't watch those. They might be too horrific.
No.
But yeah.
But also, I think it's important to emphasize that because Spacey's in a film, there were hundreds, if not thousands, of other people involved in the making of that movie. And it cheapens,
absolutely.
It's dismissing all their work if we just say, oh, fuck American Beauty and fuck Usual Suspects because Spacey's in it. I don't think that's the right way to go at all.
Exactly, man. I mean, look at a movie like Seven. That's one of my favorite of all time.
Yep.
It's much higher than what we're going to be talking about tonight, but I do love Seven. And, you know, that was really his kind of like quote unquote breakout performance. And he's fucking amazing in that as John Doe. So. Yeah, I mean, it's a tough thing, you know, as a fan, because like I said, I was a fan of his, you know, and I still am if I'm looking at his work.
Yep.
But it's just tough, man. So I agree with you. But yeah, American Beauty, notwithstanding the Spacey factor, I feel like it's just an amazing portrait of a midlife crisis in America, and that's really what it is, and it captures it so well.
Has a special place in my heart, because I think it's the first Academy Award winning film which I really was on board with. Like,
oh, okay.
Like this one, yes, great, I'm glad it won. You know, after the debacle that was Saving Private Ryan, I think maybe the year before.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, I think it was.
That almost lost me from the Academy Awards forever, that moment. But then American Beauty helped right that wrong a little bit. So, yeah. All right. Very nice. My 84 is my most critically loved film on my list of 10 today. It's a foreign language Spanish film. It's from Guillermo del Toro. It's Pan's Labyrinth from 2006.
Ooh. Good shit, man.
Film is working on multiple levels, and it basically follows, during the Spanish Civil War, a 10-year-old girl who, depending on your viewpoint, either enters a fantasy land to try to connect back with her real father, or has a psychotic break to deal with living with this abusive stepfather and being in the middle of a war while her pregnant mother sort of has no idea what she's going through. And it's just, it hits you in all the feels, this movie, in all the right ways. I don't know if that's the right way of putting it, but it's very effective. It's incredible creatures, some amazing designs, which you think about this film and immediately you're going to think about the thing with the eyes in the middle of its hands, which freaks just about everybody out. And it's just beautifully shot, amazing production design, Guillermo del Toro firing on all cylinders. And people will talk about The Shape of Water being his crowning achievement in his career because it won Best Picture, and I think he won Best Director for it. But to me, this film shits all over that one by a million miles, though they do share some DNA, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, I prefer Pan's Labyrinth too. Shape of Water, I didn't see in the theater. I saw it, I want to say, like when it came out on, you know, HBO or something like that, like maybe 6 months after it had been popular, you know?
Yep.
And I just remember kind of the hype ruined it for me a little bit because I don't know. I saw it and I go, that was what won Best Picture? Like, I don't get it. I mean, it was good. You know what I mean? Like, I liked it.
Yeah.
But I guess I was expecting to be blown away like I was with Pan's Labyrinth, and that wasn't the case.
It's nice that a fantasy sort of film about a woman banging a merman wins the Best Picture.
Right.
Yeah, you know, in a sense. But it does, again, I think, pale in comparison, get the words out eventually, in what's going on here in Pan's Labyrinth. So, but because that was a foreign language film well before Hollywood was prepared to acknowledge these kinds of things in the way it now does, and hopefully will continue to do, it was unfairly probably overlooked. And it is, on Letterboxd, it's the 210th ranked film of all time. So there's a bit of endorsement for my list on this one occasion.
No, man, you got a killer list, dude. You got a killer list.
Thanks. Very kind.
Okay, so my number 83 is, it's so funny because we haven't had crossover on movie yet, but we have crossover on director here because I got a Tony Scott film at my 83.
Cool.
And it came out in 1993, and it was not only directed by Tony Scott, but it was written by a man that you may have heard of called Quentin Tarantino.
Oh, yes, I have.
The film is True Romance. That's my number 83.
We're close.
What do you think?
We're very close to crossing there. Almost. All right. Yeah.
Okay. All right. I thought this one might be the one. I was like, I don't know. Yeah, I mean, you probably know already, man, but just a killer movie. Tarantino's dialogue and his kind of witty banter just all over the place in this movie. It was very sexy. It's very violent. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, Christian Slater, who in the 90s was, I mean, he was one of the A-list actors in the 90s. Patricia Arquette is just a darling sweetheart in this movie. And Gary Oldman, bro, as the villain Drexel in this movie. And he's been in probably 9,000 movies, you know what I mean? And True Romance will always be one of his, like, top 5 or 10 most memorable characters to me. As Drexel is kind of the greasy pimp guy that he plays. But yeah, I love this movie, man. I mean, we were mentioning it before, kind of like Tony Scott's kind of manic style of filmmaking. You were talking about it with Crimson Tide. I talked about it recently on my show with a movie he did called Man on Fire with Denzel. Mm-hmm. But he has that very kind of like quick shots and kind of like jump cuts that he does a lot in his filmaking.
Yeah, and close-ups. Close-ups,
right. Yeah, and I really enjoy that because it kind of sets the tone. And, you know, I would be remiss if I did not mention the Christopher Walken, Dennis Hopper scene in this movie.
Thank you.
One of the greatest scenes, probably of all these movies in my top 100 that I did for this, probably would be in the top 5 or 10 scenes from all of those movies combined. It's just an amazing performance by these two actors that are icons in the industry, and you can tell they're just feeding off of each other. And to have Tarantino's dialogue as their ammunition. It's just amazing. So, yeah, True Romance, you know, I could go on and on about it, and I probably have on other occasions, but that's my number 83, man.
Yeah, it's a great choice, and yeah, it's weird. There's a couple in your list this week that aren't far away on my list, and this is one of those. So,
okay.
So close. I guess I have to say, no, but not by a lot, let's put it that way. Yeah, great choice, and I will talk about it more in a future episode, but okay. that scene, oh. It's one of my absolute all-time favorites. And I'll just say this. The line of dialogue that Christopher Walken utters as that scene plays out. Look, this film's from 1994. If you haven't seen it now, you don't care. As he shoots and blows away Dennis Hopper because he's gotten so angry at him. And he says, I haven't killed anybody. Bang, bang, bang. Since 1984. That line of dialogue still resonates through my group of friends. How long since that happened?
Okay.
1984. And that's just in direct reference to that film. It had such an impact on us, that scene. So,
nice, man. Yeah, that is a powerhouse scene. It's just an acting clinic, that scene, man.
And a great end of this film where all the disparate parts come together and there's this incredible shootout.
It really is a good shootout, yeah. I'm assuming we'll do top 5 shootouts for my show at some point. I feel like this has got to be up there, man.
That could well be in there. That's a good one. All right, my number 83. My 83 is the very first film we ever reviewed on the countdown some 5 and a bit years ago. It's from Matthew Vaughn, who is one of my favorite filmmakers working despite a recent misstep. In fact, the sequel to this film was his misstep, and that this is Kingsman: The Secret Service.
Yeah, you like these, right?
This one I love. The second one I'm very middling on. I don't hate him as much as the epic film guys do, the second one, but it's very average, the second one.
Yeah, I feel like Wayne's a pretty big fan of these movies too, right?
This would be way higher on Wayne's list. If he were to bother to order his 100 favorite films, it would be exponentially higher.
All right, well, Wayne's my boy, so I don't want to upset him. So
But you don't like it. You're obviously not a fan.
No, it's not that I don't like it. I wouldn't go that far. I just, I've heard, you guys and some other podcasters and articles and things like that just kind of rave about it. And I mean, I liked it for what it was, and it was a good action. I didn't walk away from it going, well, this is, groundbreaking. I don't know. It was kind of like, okay. You know how our buddy Dan says, it's fine.
Oh, right.
That's kind of how I felt.
Unfortunately, Gerald's recording at his end, so I can't mute him at this point so I can talk freely.
Or put the soundboard over.
Soundboard in. What are you, a fucking moron?
Right, there you go, yeah. But I love it. I mean, it's a good movie. I don't know. It's fine.
Fair enough. Well, let me talk about why it makes my 100 favorite films of all time now that Gerald has taken a big turn all over it.
No, go ahead.
I think groundbreaking might not be the right word, but I think it really adds a fresh spin on the spy genre. We'd gone away in recent years from James Bond being this gritty, being this campy kind of fun character, and he's become much more gritty. And I like that much better from James Bond, don't get me wrong. But then to add this kind of fresh spin on it with this, it's gory, it's violent, it's funny. Eggsy is quite funny during the film. Sometimes it goes a little bit far, I will acknowledge, but including an infamous line towards the end of the film. But Michael Caine in it, Colin Firth absolutely killing it in a role which no one would have thought he could do. The incredible fight scene, or battle scene in the church, about 2/3 of the way through the movie. probably my only thing I don't like about the film really is Samuel L. Jackson's lisp. Otherwise, everything else I really, really dig about this film. And it's a pity the second one was so average, but I'm excited by the prequel, which is was slated to come out, I think, earlier in the year, and it's been pushed and pushed and pushed.
They've only had the two so far.
Yeah, right? The third one, okay. The King's Man, is supposed to be is a prequel set in World War One, give or take. Rasputin's okay. in it All and right. the like. And it looks like it's going to be a return to this kind of fun. I don't know what sort of happened the second one. I think trying to expand it into the American audience and shoehorning in these awkward characters just didn't work. So I'm hoping that this will reset things in a positive fashion. But yeah, Kingsman, great fun, great action scenes, pretty funny. That's why it's my 83.
Cool, man. Okay, so my 82 is a movie from a filmmaker that can be a bit divisive.
Ooh.
I tend to dig everything he does, but I do think it's an acquired taste, and I do understand people's kind of grievances with him. I don't know if you, what side of the spectrum you fall on. I guess I'll find out here in a second. But it's the only movie that would have fallen in my top 100 from this filmmaker, although I do love a lot of his works. But it's from 1997, and it's P.T. Anderson's Boogie Nights. Would be my number 82.
I would say this is the only P.T. Anderson film that I enjoy.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm glad I picked this one then. Because I like
everything else. I'm like, eh. Well, it's yeah. just long and drawn out. And yeah, the acting's good, but generally speaking, I'm watching a film for more than just acting. So
yeah, true. Yeah, no, I get it. You know, I mentioned it earlier with the different time pieces and period pieces in film, and you have two different ones in the same movie. You have the 1970s. Which is really the first half of the movie, and the second half of the movie is the 1980s. And what I love about Boogie Nights is that it really sets up those two main acts, and the first act is all sunshine and flowers and rainbows, and everybody's making pornos, and everybody's making money, and free love, and everybody loves each other. And then I don't know if you remember the scene on New Year's Eve in 1979 when it turns to 1980, and William H. Macy, and that scene ends up, you know, going into the party and killing himself in front of yep. all the guests there. Mm-hmm. And that is how 1980 starts for that group of people, and also how it starts for us in the movie. And from that moment to the end of the film, it's a steep decline in terms of feel good and happiness. And I just really love the juxtaposition that P.T. Anderson does there. I think he really balances it really well. And he kind of sets up almost two movies in the same, you know, yep. cinematic okay. thing. It's really weird how he does it. But and you mentioned the acting. I mean, come on, man. I mean, just tremendous acting. Burt Reynolds, I believe, won the Academy Award for this. I know he was nominated. Julianne yeah, Moore is amazing. We talked about William H. Macy. Heather Graham as Roller Girl. I mean, you know, I don't know if you want Creepy Gerald to come out tonight, but Roller Girl was exciting to me in 1997 when this came out as well. So, yeah, I love Boogie Nights. It probably is, though. I'm glad to hear you enjoy it, but this probably is my favorite of P.T. Anderson films, although I do love a lot of his stuff.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. It is my favorite and probably only really liked P.T. Anderson film, but I understand that I am in the minority there, that the vast majority of cinephiles really love his work across the board. So you're in good company, and I'm not going to diss it any further than that. So, yeah, it's been a long time since I've seen it, so I do starkly remember that moment in the movie that you've mentioned, but beyond that, it's a little bit hazy. I need to rewatch it, probably would be a fair assessment.
Cool, man. Well, maybe you can do it with me for my Patreon series, because it's in my it's on my list of movies to discuss for that, for Masterpiece. So okay. maybe I can get you to rewatch it,
or maybe you should get someone who really loves the film genuinely. Well, from the start,
I think you'll love it when you rewatch it, so I have faith in you.
All right. Well, my 82 is the one film, of course, from this filmmaker who started out with a bang and has gradually fallen away, though he's had a little bit of a renaissance in more recent years. I'm talking about M. Night Shyamalan's The Sixth Sense.
Okay, good one. Yeah, I think you know I love this movie.
Yeah, I think this film is, again, one of the only other films that's probably scared me sitting in a cinema with other people. Like, there was a couple of moments where I got legitimate shivers down my spine watching this movie, and Bruce Willis, when he gave a shit, Haley Joel Osment in a career-making performance, and that's the only reason we still see him today, and one of the greatest twist endings ever. Like, unfortunately, it was so good, every film that he made after that, everyone expected him, including Hollywood and the right. and the production studios, to have a twist at the end, and that probably has really stymied his career, I think, as he's tried right. to one-up himself and failed every single time. Toni Collette, yeah, again, tough, we've mentioned her once already, again, very good as a mother figure. And yeah, he sees dead people and they're creepy as fuck until he works out what the hell's going on, in which case becomes a more uplifting film. And then we get the twist. Don't know why I'm talking around it. This film's 21 years old, but did not see it coming at all. Blew me away.
Yeah, I didn't either. And that was why this movie stuck with me is just the plot twist, because I didn't see it coming either. It's such a tough thing, man, because you can tell when you watch Shyamalan movies for the most part. I mean, there are a couple duds in there. The Happening comes to mind. But generally speaking,
yeah, he's got some shit films.
But you can also tell when you watch those movies that he's a good filmmaker. Do you know what I mean? And I feel like you're exactly right that he is always going to be chasing The Sixth Sense and what he was able to do with that script and with that movie. And that's unfortunate because you could, like I said, you can tell he's a great filmmaker. It's just, I wonder if that was his peak, which would be a bummer because it was his first feature. Do you know what I mean? But, I loved Unbreakable, and there's bits and pieces of other projects of his, like Signs and some other stuff that I also like. But, I mean, Sixth Sense is definitely his best movie, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think anyone would argue too hard about that. I mean, maybe some people might say Unbreakable, but not for me, The Sixth Sense by a million miles. All right, last one then for the night or the day. Gerald, what is your 81?
All right, well, here we go, man. So I'm looking at my list. I haven't really had a comedy tonight, with the exception of, I guess, maybe The Favorite, you could argue, is a dark comedy, otherwise. So, and I also haven't had a lot of love for the 80s tonight, which I didn't do on purpose, but finally, I'm going to have a 1980s film at number 81. And you and I have both, or I should say your show and my show, have both recently done a Tom Hanks featured show. And this is probably, you know, and I'm not talking about from a merit standpoint, for like his acting or whatever, but just from an enjoyment standpoint and rewatchability. I absolutely love a comedy that he was in 1986 called The Money Pit.
Wow.
My number 81. Yeah.
It's blown my mind.
Have you seen The Money Pit?
I did, but so long ago.
Oh, man.
Like, too young to appreciate it.
Had it on VHS tape back in the day. And, I mean, I can't tell you the number of times I watched this as a kid and in high school. And really just became a Tom Hanks fan because of this movie. Shelley Long, who I had known from Cheers at the time, and I loved her on Cheers, plays his love interest and fiance in this movie. It's just so funny, man. It's such a simple premise where it's this young couple in love. They buy this house. They get a really good deal on it. They think they're getting the deal of a lifetime, and the house ends up being a piece of shit, and they got duped by these kind of con artists, and they ended up buying a lemon, and they have to fix it up. And through the course of the movie, fixing the house up, it kind of tears their relationship apart because they're fighting over money and what to fix and how to paint this and what to do. And there's so many like gags in the movie of the house falling apart. I mean, you know, I don't know if you remember the scene where, you know, Tom Hanks throws a log on the fire and the whole chimney collapses through the house, you know, shit like that. So
vague sense of the whole floor collapses at the end of the film.
Yeah, the bathtub goes through the floor and he's like hysterically has a scene where he hysterically laughs at it because he's kind of delirious, you know. But yeah, if anybody that's a Tom Hanks fan, you got to rewatch or watch The Money Pit because it's early Hanks and he's just so witty in it. He's so charismatic and there's a lot of really funny gags in it too. And I'm a big Shelley Long fan too, especially in the 80s. So The Money Pit is where I put, or 81 is where I put The Money
Pit. Well, that is the most shocking choice on your list so far. Blows away the Ed Wood factor. That could have been a bit of a comedy, by the way.
Yeah, you're right, actually. Yeah, Ed Wood has some comedic stuff too. Yeah.
But all right, well, I'm going to wrap it up then today with my 81, and it's, again, probably an underseen film, although I think it's had a bit of a renaissance in some ways of late. I think at the time it was criminally underseen, and more recently people are coming back to it in some regards. Maybe it's just in the film Twitter or the movie podcast regards, but I hear a lot more people talking about it now. It's Gavin O'Connor's Warrior, starring Joel Edgerton and Tom Hardy. Have you seen this one, Gerald?
No.
Ooh,
I haven't.
Okay.
Can you believe it? I want to, though.
You should add it to your list. It's another one that you should add to your list. It's basically a film which posits very simply, what if in a Rocky-style film where there's an underdog, what if there's two underdogs in two different ways and you kind of want them both to win for two different reasons in this tournament and they are destined to meet in the final? All right, and this adds this whole family drama. They're two brothers who have become estranged through what happens in their family that you find out in the course of the film. In some levels, they hate each other's guts. At another level, they're they're still family and they love one another. And how does this all play out? It's pretty amazing. Tom Hardy is such a physical presence in this movie. It's a mixed martial arts tournament, and it's basically put together as whoever wins this tournament will be the greatest mixed martial artist in the world. So the greatest UFC champ ever, basically. Mm-hmm. It's so well put together. Nick Nolte as a father kills it. These two are great on screen. Frank Grillo pops up. You know, he's in a lot of action movies these days as one of the trainers. Yeah.
And Joel Edgerton, you said, right?
Yeah. Yep. He's the more traditional brother, and Tom Hardy's the vet, if you will. And
okay.
Yeah, it's hard to describe how affecting this movie is. It's got a wonderful score. There's a song on this score to this day that I listen to when I run called Listen to the nice. Beethoven. It mixes in some Beethoven with some more... I'm just trying to find who the... Oh, Mark Isham was the composer, with more modern sort of sensibilities. Phenomenal film, uplifting, go through all the feelings. Warrior is my number 81.
All right, great pick, man.
So, interested to hear a couple on my list you haven't seen, a couple on your list that I haven't watched in a long time. So, this is what's cool about this, is being able to contrast tastes in film and hopefully give the listeners something to chase down and watch as, you know, we're out of lockdown, but obviously people are still staying home more than they probably normally would. So, yeah. Thank you, Gerald, so much for joining me today for 90 through 81 of our favorite films. Obviously, again, the listeners know who you are and what your show's about now, but can you tell them where to find you?
Yeah, well, thanks for having me, man. I mean, it's a blast. You know I'm a big fan of you and Wayne and your show. And,
thanks, man.
Even the bonuses that you put out, man, it's a blast. So thanks so much for having me. It's always a great time when I come on with you. Just, you know, the easiest thing is probably just follow us on Twitter at 2Ps on a Pod, which is T-W-O spelled out. We're also on Facebook and Instagram, 2Ps on a Podcast. And we're hosted on Podbean. You can find us, you know, wherever you find podcasts, but it's just 2Ps on a Podcast. And like I said, fun countdown show, guest host every week, and we try to make it fun. So, Paul, you're an inspiration, man. So thanks for having me. You know, I love you, brother.
Very kind. Love you right back. Thank you, Gerald, for joining me today. You know where to find us. Search the Countdown Movie and TV Reviews, and there's a whole bunch of places you can find us there. Links also in the show notes for all the stuff that matters in our case. But this will continue. We're going to continue counting down towards our favorite 10 films, which Wayne will be joining for. That will be the final episode of the show. Not to say that we are ending the show next week or anything along those lines. This will gradually play out. Next month, I'll have another indie movie podcast to join me for, what will that be, 80 through 71. And spoilers, you'll hear a couple of films from today again on that list. But there we go. And all right, that's it. Thank you so much for joining us again today. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks to Gerald. My name is Paul.
My name is Gerald.
And see ya next month, hopefully next week, for the regular episodes. Cheers.